McGill Daily of the Daily.
I'm McGill Daily.
Hi, I'm calling from the McGill Daily. Can I ask you some questions?
This is a little bit diplomatic.
News. Can you design?
Could I see you for a second?
We're going to cap this.
News, can you dummy?
Did that story come in yet?
Editorial's in 5 minutes.
McGill Daily.
I'm fit to pray.
You're listening to Unfit to Print, a McGill Daily and CKUT collaboration. Unfit to Print is a bi-weekly radio segment produced by student contributors who strive to push the limits of radio journalism. My name is Ali, and I'll be your host today. On today's program, we bring you coverage from the Occupy Central rally in Montreal, where over 100 attendees rallied in solidarity with student protesters in Hong Kong. But first, we'll hear an interview with Vice President of University Affairs, Claire Stewart-Cannigan, about the recent letter that the Student Society of McGill posted on their website calling for action on addressing sexual violence on campus. This letter is a response to the news that broke in late September that domestic violence-related charges were filed against a McGill Redmond player. The McGill Daily's Drew Rolfson-Bell sat down with Claire Stewart-Cannigan yesterday.
We are joined today by Claire Stewart-Cannigan, Vice President of Universities Affairs. We will be discussing the letter that SMU posted on their blog calling for action on addressing sexual assault after a Redmond football player was arrested in late September. How are you doing today, Claire?
I'm doing pretty well, thanks. How about yourself?
I'm pretty good. Could you briefly describe the letter that SMU posted on its blog and the need to post such a strong response so quickly?
Yeah, so SMU found out about this arrest as at the same time as the rest of the university, and so we definitely felt that having a strong response was necessary to avoid this incident from becoming detached from past incidences that we've seen in the football community, like at McGill, or just like in like athletics at McGill in general. You know, the university did act quickly in suspending this player, but we did feel that it was essential to keep the public eye on the broader context on our dissatisfaction with the university's handling of cases relating to sexual violence. We also felt in our letter that it was important to center the conversation around sexual violence and its presence in certain communities, because in the university's response, they stated that the player had been arrested for various charges kind of thing, they neglected to add the context, which was a context of domestic violence. So we felt it was essential to bring the conversation back around to gendered violence so that it wouldn't be erased from the discussion at the McGill end of things.
Do you think McGill's stubbornness to label certain areas or communities as higher risk for sexual assault or certain forms of sexual violence is a part of the problem?
Yeah, I don't think it's useful to avoid looking at certain areas because you don't want certain areas to feel targeted. The university is pretty uncomfortable with the phrase high risk because that you know, when you say something, some area is high risk or something like that, or there's a high reported incidence, then they're going to want stats kind of thing, like what are the statistics in here versus here and everything. And especially with sexual violence, like those are extremely difficult statistics to report. But yeah, the university has you know, collaborated with students and other groups to take action on preemptively addressing the toleration of sexual violence in communities like in Res or in Frosch and things, in positions where people are in positions of student leadership and things like that, and these areas have been recognized as you know, like the phrase high risk is not a popular phrase, but I would say high risk. So it's not useful to keep dragging our heels and bringing every group like into it kind of thing. And you know, if you're going to be targeting your resources somewhere, you may as well target in an area that's received, you know, a lot of publicity around these kind of issues. And it's not just at McGill. So if we're going to be taking the time to target folks in Frosch and Res, then we should definitely be applying the same lens to athletics.
Mm. How do you feel about the statement that Deputy Provost made following the charges that Mr. Moda should have never been allowed to join the team? Do you agree?
So as far as the question of whether the player should have been allowed to join the team, the university's stance that it took in that letter, stating that the player should not have been allowed to join the team, and that's not in accordance with the university's values. It does suggest that the university is saying that it doesn't believe that in the capacity of rehabilitation to be successful. However, it also it's difficult for Smooter to take a definite position on this question, because we don't have access to the full information. There seems to be conflicting messages coming out from the media, from athletics. In the coach's letter, he had stated that this individual had done his time, he needs a second chance. But while in the media, it's saying that he was still serving his sentence. And But the university and athletics together have not been clear on, you know, what stage was this sentence at, and so if they're going to be dealing with the question of whether this person should or should not have been able to play, they need to first come forward with all of the details. You know, who all knew about this, and did the university plan on being a part of the rehabilitative process? That's what the letter from the coach seems to suggest, that he believes in the power of sport to be a tool in rehabilitation. And fair statement, but what steps was athletics taking to make the sport and football a part of the rehabilitative process, and not something that could potentially do harm to this individual's rehabilitative process? It's unclear what steps were being taken. It seems like an all or nothing. Like, the university either completely knows about the charges and just chooses to, give this person have the exact same experience as anybody else on the football team, or they're claiming that they didn't know, and so it's disastrous, and they shouldn't have been allowed to be on there in the first place. Instead of maybe looking at the middle ground of, okay, if people were aware of this, what additional measures could have been taken, so that if down the road this person does reoffend, then the university can say that, and athletics can say that it did what it could to make this person's time on the team part of their rehabilitative process. And right now, it doesn't appear that they are able to say that they took the necessary steps.
Do you think part of the problem is that McGill Athletics seems to be compartmentalizing its problems? And there's a lack of communication between the athletic department and the university, which leads to a lack of transparency, perhaps?
It's difficult because when the university says that they don't know something, and athletics says, like, no, you absolutely did know this, as kind of... as an outsider, it's McGill would have an incentive to say that no, we didn't know that this was happening, to kind of wash their own hands of any kind of responsibility. So when they say that they didn't know, it's difficult for us to know, like, did you actually not know, or are you just trying to avoid accountability and put this problem somewhere else so that you don't have to deal with it publicly? So as far as the information that we're getting, like, because of McGill's track record of trying to kind of distance themselves from it, which they showed themselves to really be trying to do in that response, which was really criticized by national media and everything, like, it was clear what they were trying to do. It's difficult to know, like, does a communication problem actually exist, or is this more just another tactic of McGill to avoid coming to terms with these issues and acknowledging its own responsibility for dealing with them.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of track records, the rhetoric surrounding this case is that it was the second time in about 3 years that McGill Athletics has run into a problem around sexual violence or sexual assault. But in reality, this is the third time in the last 9 years, the first occasion mm-hmm. being in 2005, where the program was actually suspended mm-hmm. in order to fix these problems. Do you think there has been any change since 2005?
Well, the problem that they or the response to the incident in back in 2005 with the chanting was to suspend the football season, and also to institute mandatory workshops on consent and things. That was the promise. As far as I know, that has not been followed through. So it seems as though numerous incidents have not resulted in a major culture shift. If we just looking on the ground at what kind of initiatives exist now that didn't exist before, in response to the incidents of sexual assault last year, athletics response, which was it's totally condoned by the university, it seems, is to revise their code of student conduct and make it a little stronger. But in terms of instituting any actual trainings or any actual new steps that that athletes have to go through, it as far as I know, there has not and I've asked the university about this in Senate and things, and there have not been any new trainings or anything like that instituted. So it doesn't really seem as though there has been much of a shift as far as what we can see from the efforts that are existing on the ground. Nothing's going to change unless there are actual concrete steps being taken at the ground level, and those steps don't seem to have been taken, and there hasn't been any reassurance as far as having several clean years or anything like that for us to say things have changed, we've taken steps. It doesn't seem like steps have been taken, and from what we're seeing kind of in this pattern, it's not showing that there's been much growth in that area.
Mm. Mm-hmm. It's clear that the university needs to make a stronger commitment to both its students and the community at large. And buzzwords such as rehabilitation or certain programs put in place, if they aren't used, they aren't anything but that, just words. There has to be a strong commitment. What changes do you think can be made viably to make McGill a safer space for all of its students?
I think that athletics needs to stop being compartmentalized as this untouchable space for dealing with questions of sexual violence, with dealing with how gender-based oppression expresses itself in that community. A lot of other communities have taken steps towards bringing those conversations into their own communities and things. And I think it's certainly time for athletics to step up on that front. It's not useful right now for the university and athletics to be pointing fingers at each other, which seems to be what's happening through these statements. The university saying they didn't know, athletics saying they did know, but it seems like neither of them are willing to address the more central question of how we how we deal with cultures of sexual violence on our campus, and the fact that those cultures do exist on our campus. Both departments need to stop ignoring that piece of it and start integrating it into a meaningful place in the experience of McGill athletes. Those workshops should be mandatory. They're, I would really hope to see collaboration with some of the students who are in athletics to push for these within their own departments. I don't think anyone wants to see these kind of cases coming to light. So if the students are willing to talk to people within their own department and things like that to get these kind of workshops integrated in a mandatory way into all their experiences, and in an extensive way, then I think that would be a meaningful step. And it can't just be for this year. It can't just be as a response to the media to kind of quell the criticism that's going to McGill. These need to be long-term workshops. These need to be institutionalized to make sure that they don't fall away. We have people in the office of the Dean of Students who are working specifically on the subject of sexual assault, who could definitely provide trainings and things like that, or even train people within athletics to give more peer-based workshops on consent. That was what was done in Frosch this last year, and from what I've heard, it went over quite well. We have those resources on campus, and so it's definitely time for athletics to to collaborate with those resources and take advantage of the options that we do have available on campus for bringing these kinds of trainings and into the experience of all McGill athletes.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Claire.
Happy to be here.
That was an interview with VP of University Affairs, Claire Stewart-Cannigan. To hear the longer version of the interview, go to www.mcgilldaily.com/podcast. On October 1st, hundreds rallied outside of the McConnell Engineering Building in support of the Occupy Central movement. The Daily's Hara Chan was there.
This week, we hear voices from a rally in support of Occupy Central, which consisted of over 100 attendees and took place outside the McConnell Engineering Building on McGill campus on October 1st. It began at 2 p.m. and lasted until 4 p.m. Speeches were given in support of Occupy Central, including a diversity of opinions regarding the question of whose democracy is being fought for, as well as economic and migrant worker issues, which have been largely ignored by the mainstream media. After the speeches, attendees were invited to sign a petition in support of Occupy Central, which will be presented to the Chinese consulate in Montreal.
I'm Vincent Tao, and I'm a member of No One's Illegal Montreal. I believe it should be our priority here to stand against the state's brazen use of violent police force in response to Monday's protests in Hong Kong's downtown core. While the HKP's most recent display of state-sanctioned brutality is plainly appalling and must be condemned internationally, it is anything but surprising in this day and age. Sadly, we have come to expect that when people take to the streets and attempt to exercise their right to occupy a public space in any given global financial hub, they will inevitably be met with the blunt end of a cop's nightstick. From Montreal to Hong Kong, police forces around the world are charging ahead in a one-sided arms race with the people. While we pick up umbrellas and bottles, cops are brandishing bigger and better instruments of war every day. So whether a protester decides to break a window or pick up after their own garbage, we must denounce police brutality in any place and in any form. All police brutality is excessive. I am the son of Hong Kongers, Ngo Hai Hong Kong Yan, so I cannot describe the complicated feelings of longing and belonging I felt when I first saw the images of Victoria Square filled with people my age marching for what they believe in. But when the deluge of Western media reports came pouring in, the idealized images of people power became at once terribly distorted and painfully clear. From The Times to The Economist, Western media outlets are obsessed with the idea of a famously orderly and clean Hong Kong, a postcard image of the prosperous global financial center painted with a nostalgia for the city's time under British colonial rule. At the same time, the press releases recycled age-old language of yellow peril, warning of the ever-looming threat of a backwards and always fundamentally undemocratic China. Reporters perpetuate stereotypes of Occupy Central protesters as model minorities, an image strategically mobilized to shame the anti-authoritarian actions of our black and brown brothers and sisters in Ferguson and abroad. So contrary to the notion that this is the first time in Hong Kong's history that the people are coordinating themselves with little direction from government and institutions, with an exceptional air of middle-class decorum at that, we must be reminded that in May of 1967, the youth of my father's generation set off bombs in the fight for decent work conditions and social planning initiatives from Hong Kong's negligent colonial administration. What must not be erased here is the long history of labor organizing, social justice, and protests in Hong Kong. But more importantly, I fear what else might be erased is what democracy really means. What is lost in the flood of images of youthful students peacefully marching in the streets is the fact that Hong Kong's population of 7 million are not all MBA prospects and would-be hedge fund managers. In the reports of protests streaming in as I speak, why is there no mention of the appalling income gap in Hong Kong, of how 1 in 5 of the city's population are below the poverty line, of how suicide rates in the city's poorer neighborhoods are 3.5 times higher than they are in the adjacent financial districts? When the world measures Hong Kong's so-called prosperity by skyrocketing property prices, it is a sad inevitability that Occupy Central's televised cry for democracy makes no mention of demands for public housing. So let me ask you, what is this democracy and who is it for? Will universal suffrage be extended to the foreign domestic workers from Indonesia, the Philippines, Nepal, Thailand, and Bangladesh that make up 10% of the island's workforce? When Leung Chun-ying is ousted as the city's chief executive, will there be an end to Hong Kong's live-in rule and two-week rule that forced migrant women into a force of state-approved slavery? When Hong Kong achieves true democracy, will there be justice for Irwanya, the 23-year-old live-in care worker who was just 1 year ago found to be kept in a cage and tortured by her employers? When migrant workers must silence themselves in the face of overwhelming rates of verbal, physical, and sexual abuse from the employers they must live with for fear of near-immediate deportation, how can we begin to talk about democracy? So I urge you to ask yourselves, what is at stake in Hong Kong's so-called pro-democracy movement, and who does Occupy Central represent? Does universal suffrage for Hong Kong just mean universal suffrage for middle-class Hong Kong Chinese? I believe that democracy is bankrupt without justice and dignity for all peoples.
I'm actually an exchange student here. I'm from Hong Kong. I was born and raised in Hong Kong. I'm 21 now. I spent 21 years in Hong Kong. So it's my first time in Canada, and this happened. Never in my life I've been like wanting to go back home so much. Like, when we come outside, we always feel like freedom and all that. But now Hong Kong's this thing is happening now. My friends are outside. My secondary school friends, friends from my university, they're fighting for democracy, and I'm here. I feel so terrible about that. Basically, I don't want to give a long speech because. First of all, my English is not that good, and actually I can't really think straight now. So sorry, I apologize in advance if my things I'm gonna say is actually unorganized. The first thing I want to say is that I'm really proud of being a Hong Kongese, Hong Konger, whatever you call it these days. Because ever since SARS, when I was like still in primary school, that's the first time I really felt that like Hong Kong is united. We fight together. We fight SARS. This is the second time. Well, everyone steps out, they take their stance, they fight for democracy in a peaceful way. I have to say this really touches me. We see videos and photos on Instagram, Facebook, whatever social media that we have now. What we see is that we're not fighting in a brutal way. No violence, but peace. Today is the National Day of China, I believe we all know that, and there's this flag raising ceremony in Hong Kong and Wan Chai. What really touched me is that a group of students who are actually fighting for democracy, they went to the place, they stood together, and what they do is like to stop other people from ruining the ceremony. They don't want them to interrupt it, because we know once we do that, we'll give others excuses to fight back. If we stay peaceful, then we will win. Others can't, like, they don't have a reason to bring us down. The second thing that I really want to talk about is I want to remind everyone of why are we here. I couldn't be in Hong Kong, but now I'm here in Canada. It's my responsibility to let others know what's happening in Hong Kong, and to gain awareness and let the world like know what Hong Kong's like happening. What we're fighting for is not for Leung Chun-ying to step down. That's not what we're fighting for. We're still a part of China. We don't want to be our own country. That's not what we should do. We're still a part of China. Not fighting for Leung Chun-ying to Hatai. We're not fighting for like some ridiculous reasons for like against communism and all that. What we're fighting is for democracy. We have to bear that in mind. We want to have our own votes, to have our own chief executive. That's what's most important. A lot of people these days, they're angry. So am I. I'm very angry. But there's something dangerous about anger. It blinds us. If we're angry, we can't think straight. We don't know what we're fighting for. So it actually gives me a really good chance to stay out here because I can think more clear. I'm away from Hong Kong for this moment because I can see, so I can see clearer. I know what's happening. I know what we are fighting for. there are, I saw this video this morning. There's a man who doesn't like speak Cantonese fluently. He was tearing down all those banners, all those postcards. He was actually, I'm sorry, posters, and all those things that we props to like support to fight for democracy. The Hong Kong people managed to stay calm. They didn't fight back. They didn't like blame him. They just watched him do that, and then put it back on, stick the posters back, have the banners on again. I'm really proud of that because we managed to stay calm. We know that if we don't, if we're not in peace, we'll give others a chance. So I really want to remind all of us that the sole and only purpose for this thing is we need democracy, and we're fighting for that. When Hong Kong starts, we stay, step forward, the world will follow. And I actually never introduced myself because I'm gonna do it now. I'm doing it. It's the first time that I introduce myself like proudly and with pride. I'm Kevin. I'm from the University of Hong Kong, and I feel proud of.
Hi everyone. My name is Ashley, and I'm a citizen of Hong Kong. I was born and raised in Hong Kong in 1992, and I only came to Canada 4 years ago because of Miguel. I'm here today to just share a few thoughts about the movement in Hong Kong right now. So on September 22nd is the first day of the Hong Kong class boycott. I have friends who are in universities in Hong Kong right now, and they all went to the Chinese University of Hong Kong, the campus, for the class boycott. And there were at least, I don't know how many people, but there were thousands and thousands of students on the campus fighting for their own right, fighting for the future of our generation. Some people say that we are just, you know, reckless and we don't care about people, but we know what we're doing. Like, people said that we don't know what democracy is. But I have friends who are in universities right now. They went to the protest. They started up a team that reports at the front line. He was in the medical team. He is in the medical team at the front line. He got tear gassed, like attacked by tear gas.
Hello, everyone. I'm from mainland China, and I'm really sorry to see what's now happening in Hong Kong, that the police started to do things really brutal. And I want to remind all of you that the reason that today we are here is to supporting the people in Hong Kong, the students in Hong Kong. And also, please don't forget that the reason we are here is to make sure that we give pressure to Beijing to make sure that the government is going to starting to talk with people. So I'm really glad that I can be here, and they know, and even it's a less part of the people, we still know what's happening. And we spread our words on the internet, in WeChat, in whatever way we can, so people can know what's happening and can know that democracy can be real. The other thing is, to fighting for real democracy is going to take a long time. From now until 2017, the negotiation with Chinese government will be difficult. We want things to move forward, we want to see progress, but you have to know this is not going to happen today or the day after, it's going to happen in years. So people in Hong Kong, please stay strong, and you have the support from people all around the world, and you have the support from people in mainland China.
Once again, those were sounds from the Occupy Central rally, which took place October 1st. That does it for this edition of Unfit to Print. Thank you to Drew and Hera for their pieces. For more on both the Occupy rally and the McGill Redmond case and other stories, pick up this week's edition of the McGill Daily. And finally, if you are interested in getting involved with Unfit to Print, email us at multimedia@mcgilldaily.com. No experience is required to get involved. Also, make sure to like our Facebook page, Unfit to Print, the McGill Daily Radio.
Unfit to Print.